From NPR and WBUR, I'm Femi Okay.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The national debate over separation of children from their families at the border continues. The Trump administration enacted a policy of prosecuting all unlawful border crossings instead of detaining families together as civil cases. And because of that, children have to be separated from their parents. Republicans like Michigan Congressman Fred Upton are calling for an end to this ugly and inhumane practice. But there are supporters. Sandy Rios is host of the Sandy Rios in the Morning Show on the American Family Radio Network. Sandy, we're hearing the sound of children crying for their parents. Make your case.
Well, you know, who wants to see children separated from their parents? All of our hearts go out, but that doesn't mean that it's exactly what it's being presented as. You know, we have so many Americans consigned to prisons because they've broken the law. Now, we don't have any audio that I know of American children being separated from their parents when they go to prison. But I guarantee you there would be a lot of cries and sadness. It would break your heart. Is that the fault of the American people, or is it the fault of the parent who has broken the law?
But we're talking about immigrants, this is a country of immigrants, which has traditionally been treated differently. In fact, the Obama administration, when they tried to do something along the same lines in 2014, when there was a huge surge of families fleeing violence in Central America and astonishing number of children, far more than there are today, the Obama administration tried to not give bonds to these families as a way of forcing them to stay in detention and to try to do the same thing, to send a signal and discourage other families from coming. But a district court in 2015 ruled you can't send a signal through someone by punishing them to someone else. Do you worry about the constitutionality of this?
Well, the constitutionality is pretty obvious, Robin. Look, the executive branch doesn't pass laws. It's only the Congress that can do that. But here's the thing. This is a misreporting and a misrepresentation. Parents have separated themselves from their own children in most of these cases, willingly sent them off either with someone else or by themselves to make that dangerous trek.
And why do you think they did
that? United States.
Why do you think they did that?
Because America is the greatest country in the world.
That's one reason, but it's also because of the tremendous violence in their home countries. And many of them are trying to seek asylum. Many of the people who have been separated from their children are trying to seek asylum, and they've gone to the wrong port of entry.
You do know that the asylum laws that are on the books have been abused. And I would ask you to consider this. If we follow the logic of our emotions, which are being played right now, so then there is no limit to the amount of children and persons we allow into the United States. We cannot handle anymore. We have our own children to think about. We have the Kate Steinleys, who were definitely separated from their parents by an illegal immigrant.
Kate Steinle, who was shot and killed in San Francisco.
By an illegal immigrant. We have to consider that our emotions need to be guided by reason. And we are not responsible for the entire world and all of its violence and problems. We do have a very generous asylum policy. People are just flooding over the border, and so there's no way the agents can actually discern who's telling the truth about asylum and who isn't.
Well, that's their job, though. I mean, that's their job.
Yes, but agents are people. They can't handle overwhelming numbers of people coming across the border. I don't think anybody reasonably expects that they can. You know, we had border agents during the Obama administration that were learning to change diapers and do child care because they were so overwhelmed with all the numbers of children coming.
But what do you think about what some Republicans are offering in some of these new bills, though, which is go back to the civil detention, keep the children with the families?
What I'm saying is that most of those kids are not coming with their parents. They're coming sometimes with sex traffickers. They're coming with a lot of the MS-13 gang members and others.
Well, first of all, the M13 gang started in Los Angeles, and there are definitely people who are fraudulently bringing children because they know that children would be, you know, a front for them. But the majority, the people who have been in the detention centers, the majority of these children that are separated have family that are being held. I mean, that's the majority. What would you suggest?
I think we need to enforce our immigration laws. We need to stop the massive migration on the southern border. And if it starts on the northern border, we should stop it there. I think we should put America first.
Let me ask you something. If these children, if their families are prosecuted, these children are now in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services, they will go into the foster care system. They will still flood into American cities. Isn't it better to send the families intact back?
There may be a few families intact down there, but I think most of the kids, as we said, are by themselves or with the other people that they're not even related to. So this is a misconstruing of a really, honestly, Robin, if something is happening to kids that's unfair, unjust, you talk about unfair or unjust. Do you have any idea? I'm sure you do. The dangers that parents are putting their children in by sending them on these long treks with strangers.
Well, as someone said to, as one of the asylum seekers said to a reporter, if you have a 50% chance of surviving if you leave your country, but you'll definitely be killed and your children will if you stay, taking that journey is an easy choice. Let me just ask you something. Are you pro-life?
Yes, ma'am.
How does this, what's happening with these children, square with that?
Robin, I'm not advocating the murder of children. I'm talking about a reasonable policy that will help as many people as possible. I am factoring in the fact that American children are suffering because we are pouring so much money into helping illegal immigrants. Our own children, our schools are overcrowded, our medical facilities, our emergency rooms. It's just a common sense principle. We cannot save everyone. We can't feed everyone. We can't prevent all children from being separated from their parents. It's an impossible bar.
That's Sandy Rios, host of the Sandy Rios in the Morning Show on American Family Radio. Sandy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate the chance.
Abortion is illegal across much of Latin America, but Argentina is considering legislation that would legalize abortion in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. The BBC's Daniel Pardo joins us from Buenos Aires. And Daniel, the vote to make abortion legal in the lower house was passed 129 to 125. How contentious was that debate?
Very. This is something that most Argentines had to something to say about. I mean, in conversations in TV, in radio, but also in social media, we saw everyone talking about it. And it was something that everyone was involved in. I mean, many, many public figures, you know, actresses, football players even, got involved in the debate, went to talk shows, you know, primetime talk shows, to say what they thought. So it was something that not only because of the fact of the law itself, that it's something very important for many people, but also because it became sort of a symbol for the fight against machismo, against for feminist rights. So obviously, Argentina is one of the countries that has a tradition of political debate, right? And protests here take place every day. But this was something special and symbolic.
Supporters of the bill have been celebrating. But what happens next?
So it passed in the Chamber of Congress, and now it has to go to Senate. The important thing to have in mind here is that in Senate, the interior of the country, what they say, el interior, those regions that are not the capital, which is very influential. In those parts, the representation is bigger in Senate, and that in a way shows that the challenge is going to be bigger for the law to pass in the Senate, especially because the church has more influence in those regions that have more representation in Senate. So if it was contentious in chamber, now it's going to be even more.
Give us a sense of how big a shift this could be in Argentina if abortion is legalized for the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. How big a cultural change could that be?
It is a huge cultural change for a country that, even though that it's very conservative, has always kind of led this progressive movements in Latin America. This is the first country where female vote was approved in the region, the first country where gay marriage was approved in the region. So it is very symbolic. It's very important, not only for Argentina, but for the whole of Latin America. And it will change many things in practice. I mean, many hospitals would have to practice abortion, even if the hospital is church funded or their doctors don't want to practice it. They will have to do it to protect what feminists are saying, the life of many women who go and practice abortions in clandestine situations.
Daniel, the rallying cry from the supporters for more abortion rights in Argentina, they are shouting, abortion will be law. Why are they so confident?
Because it's part of the campaign, and I guess in politics you have to show confidence to be able to pass it. But there are arguments to be a skeptic, because as I was saying, in the Senate, the influence of the church is bigger, and conservative movements are going to do all they can to prevent this law from passing. But on the other hand, the movement, the social movement and feminist has been huge, and this has become such a controversial topic that for a member of parliament to not approve it, it's going to be quite controversial. It's going to be something that they're going to have to argument with their voters. Do they want to? I don't know. In a point where the economy is in huge problems, I guess this is something that might be able to drain some sort of energy for people.
Months more campaigning still to go before the Senate cast their vote. The BBC's Daniel Pardo in Buenos Aires. Daniel, thank you.
Sure, happy to do it.
Back to our top story, the Trump administration's policy of separating many undocumented families crossing the U.S. border. Humanitarian groups in Texas say the so-called zero-tolerance policy is creating a strain on resources and uncertain futures for those families. From member station KUT, Ashley Lopez reports.
Sarah Valdez is the supervising attorney for the children's program at AICES, which provides legal assistance to immigrants in Texas. Like other attorneys in her office, she says they've been really busy lately.
It's just been a shock to the system and kind of game planning. What are we going to do to help out these folks and these kids?
Valdez says the scale of these family separations is unprecedented, and our group is just trying to figure out how to tackle as many cases as they can.
So, I mean, we're already strategizing and changing kind of what we're doing, but I think there is I feel at least a little bit in shock of, okay, like, we got to figure this out.
But one of the issues, she says, is that there's a lot of uncertainty. For one, there isn't clarity from the federal government on whether or when these families will be reunited.
I think that when people look to me as an attorney to say, what do you think I should do? People want definite answers, and I can't give definite answers right now.
And that uncertainty has also been a challenge for groups who contract with the federal government to hold these kids and provide services to them. Dr. Juan Sanchez is the founder and president of Southwest Key Programs. His group has been working with the federal government for the past 20 years doing this work. Sanchez says even he doesn't know if or when families will be reunited.
We don't know yet because we don't know where this is going. It's a recent policy. It hasn't all been worked out. What we are doing is maintaining a relationship between the child and the family member, wherever they may be, and making sure they understand that we have the child, and as soon as they are able to take their child back, that's what we'd like to do, is connect them again.
But as far as a possible timeline for that, Sanchez says he has no idea. And in the meantime, he says he's trying to hire childcare workers, clinicians, and administrative staff to meet the needs of these children being separated from their parents. And he says they are running out of space as well.
We're at a maximum right now, pretty close to it. We got about 230 additional beds. When we get to 6,000, we're going to be maxed out. And there's a lot of work, discussions now about where are these kids going to go.
Sanchez says about 10% of the children they're holding for the federal government have been separated from their parents under this new policy. And as far as the future of this policy, neither Juan Sanchez or Sarah Valdez with Raices says they have any idea how this will play out.
Is it sustainable? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know how as a country we can continue to treat people like this. And I think as a legal community, as an advocacy community, we're not going to stand for this policy as it is. And we're going to fight for fairness.
The Trump administration has said leading up to this new policy that it is meant to be a deterrent to illegal immigration. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
With children and immigration in the news, there's a kids' book out that seems particularly timely. In Kelly Yang's novel Front Desk, Mia Tang is a 10-year-old girl from China. She lives with her parents at the Cala Vista Home Motel in California. And even though the Cala Vista is only 5 miles from Disneyland, Mia's existence is no fairy tale. For a meager salary, her parents clean the motel's rooms while Mia is in charge of the front desk. A 10-year-old helping to run a motel might seem unbelievable, but Front Desk was inspired by Kelly Yang's own life. Kelly, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So that moment when your parents said, we are going to America, how did they break that to you? What were you thinking?
I was shocked, you know, I mean, I didn't really know that much about it. And they said, yeah, we're going to go to America. You know, we're going to have a new life. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to have freedom and a house with a dog. And it just seemed like a dream come true.
And how old were you?
I was 6.
So I'm looking at the top of your Twitter feed, and pinned right there is a school report card and a letter from your teacher. And it starts like this. Yang entered Shiraz February the 19th, 1991. She could speak, underlined, no English. How did you manage?
It was horrible. I didn't speak a word of English, not even the word girl, which as a girl, that's really bad. You can't even find the bathroom. And I remember the teacher had another student translate for me. This was another Chinese kid. But for some reason, he didn't want to translate half the time what I was saying. And so I was just like a mute, just sort of sitting there. And I couldn't get what I wanted. And I couldn't advocate for myself or participate in anything. It was only towards the end of the year that I spoke up. I think I said, like, I want some water. And everybody just kind of froze, was like, oh,
She speaks.
And my teacher, based on that, decided to put me in the second grade, even though I was pretty much failing in all of my English courses.
There's an author's note at the back of front desk, and it describes this life that you had. So there you were trying to grapple with English, this new second language. Mm-hmm. And you were also running the front desk of your parents' motel, the motel that they worked in. And you describe it as you both loved and feared the front desk.
Right.
Can you explain what that means?
I loved it because I was able to get adults to listen to me, which is like every kid's dream, you know, to ask an adult, a 30-year-old, give me your ID. And they would have to hand it over to this 8-year-old. So it was kind of thrilling in that sense. But I was also really scared because, you know, we would have different situations, like the police would come or, you know, something would happen with the customers and I would be blamed. So it was a little bit of a challenge for me as a little kid.
There will be people who will be very critical of parents who put a youngster at the front desk of a motel and she has to go to school and do her schoolwork at the same time. How do you react to that?
You know, I think that for a lot of families, it's not necessarily always a choice. You know, my parents came with $200 in their pocket. We struggled very, very hard in the States. And we took on, I mean, they took on some horrible jobs. And I was part of that. And when we got to the motel that we were managing, there were just simply too many rooms. There was no way they could clean all the rooms and man the front desk. And I decided, hey, I want to take this challenge. You know, I want to do this.
Kelly, what did you do? I'm trying to imagine an 8-year-old running the front desk in a motel. What was your life like? How were you doing it?
Yeah, it was hard. You know, it was hard to get the customers to treat me with the respect that they would give my mom, you know, like an adult, you know, because I would say something like, it's time to check out now, sir. And they would be like, nah, you know. So it was really hard. And I had to work really hard at that. And I really prided myself on my customer service skills and just trying to make everybody happy and feel at home. That was a big part of the story as well as the community, because we did have regulars living in the motel and they were called the weeklies because they paid by the week. And we became a sort of a little family. And they were the ones who really taught us about America, you know, that it wasn't this fairy tale place where, you know, you get to live in a house with a dog and that there were nuances to that.
The family in the book, the Tang family, they hide and they support immigrants.
Right.
This is such a, it's so topical right now. Mm-hmm. And you have been wading into conversations about immigration today.
Yeah,
I know,
absolutely.
Because you posted about it. Why?
I think what's happening with immigration is heartbreaking to see families getting separated at the border. It doesn't stand up to the values that America is supposed to espouse that is, you know, an inspiration to people all over the world. It's inhumane, some of the things that are happening. And I think it all comes down to a lack of understanding of immigrants and what they have to go through and how they contribute to our country. And so I hope that through reading this story of a little girl, it really opens people's eyes, especially children and the next generations, that we have more empathy.
I was surprised at a particular air of pushback. I wasn't expecting it. And it came from a Vietnamese-American writer called Viet Thanh Nguyen. And he is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He didn't like your book, and his critique was it made all Asian Americans feel bad about themselves and gave Asian American tiger parents another story to tell their underachieving kids. Thanks, Kelly. I didn't get that. Do you understand it?
I think that he was responding to a tweet where I talked about, you know, the fact that immigrants who come with no English, it doesn't mean that they can't succeed. And my story is, after working in the motels, I had an opportunity to go to college early, and I took it, and I went to college at 13, and then I went to Harvard Law School. And I think that he, I don't know if he's read Front Desk, but I think he was responding to, like, sort of the later part of my bio and thinking that I was sort of the product of tiger parents and that I was this overachiever, when in fact my parents struggled to just put food on the table. They didn't have time to even know what I was studying, and half the time they were just too busy doing all their stuff to just maintain our lives. I got a lot of support from teachers and librarians. They were the ones who really made me who I am and gave me the confidence to be a writer in English, which my parents always called English, you know, the white kid's language. Like, why bother, you know, why bother thinking that you could do a good job in English when you weren't born with it. So I think he just sort of maybe didn't know the whole story.
If there was a message that you wanted to leave kids and their parents with, what's your takeaway for them?
I think the message is that we're a community of many, many, many different types of people from all walks of life, and we need to do a better job of reaching out to each other and listening to our stories, whatever they might be, however different, and not feeling this shame. Because when I was working in the motels, I never once had a friend come over because I thought it was weird and embarrassing that I worked in a motel. So, you know, just imagine what that's like growing up to never have a friend come over, like not for a single birthday party or anything, because I felt that that was just the wrong narrative. And the fact that this book is out there and is such an unconventional story, I think will hopefully inspire a lot of kids to say, hey, this is my life and it's awesome. And, you know, I want to share with you. And when we have more of that, that's how we're going to get more empathy.
Kellyanne, thank you so much for being on Here and Now. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's here and now. You've been there. Rush hour on the interstate, a traffic jam, and a few drivers trying to get ahead by changing lanes. But does it work? David Hyde from member station KUOW in Seattle went to find out, with the help of one of the station's listeners.
Is traffic weaving worth it? University of Washington traffic expert Mark Hallenbach says he can't answer that question. No researcher has looked at lane changing under real highway conditions. What he can say...
Weaving is disruptive. Disruption reduces efficiency. Reductions in efficiency cause congestion. So we don't like weaving.
But Hallenbach admits that sometimes you might get there a little faster by weaving, especially if you're willing to be a jerk. So, let's find out. I'm in my car about to get on I-5, headed south into heavy Seattle traffic. In another car is Mariah St. Clair. She's a listener who wrote in and asked us to answer this question. Does traffic weaving work? So today, Mariah's headed to work downtown about 6 miles away. And for this unscientific experiment, she's going to pick a lane and stick with it. And I'm going to change lanes a bit, and we'll see who gets there faster.
It's pretty backed up, as usual.
I'm a car behind Mariah, so she's got a head start.
I like to stay in this lane so that mostly I just can keep going. So it's kind of slow and steady wins the race is my plan.
Okay, I'm weaving. Okay, I'm weaving again. There's a man in a blue Prius behind me right now, and he's shaking his head and making a weaving symbol with his hand, like his hand is like a fish swimming through the water, and he's shaking his head like, you idiot, stop weaving.
The thing is, he was right. At that point, after weaving in and out of traffic, I was way behind Mariah. So why did it seem like I would get there way ahead of her by changing lanes? Dr. Donald Rettelmeyer has studied that.
Under congested roadways, our own eyes start to play tricks on us. It makes it seem that the next lane is going faster than the lane we're in right now. And by the way, that illusion holds for every driver on the roadway.
Redlmeyer is a Canadian science researcher and co-author of a study of traffic weaving. And he wanted to know, do drivers make good decisions about changing lanes? The researchers had subjects look at computer simulations because it would be unethical to ask drivers to really change lanes on a real highway for an experiment. And they found out that most people believed that the next lane was going faster, even though it wasn't. But obviously, sometimes you've got to weave.
Of course you've got to change lanes. You'd be a bozo not to do it.
The problem is that drivers overestimate the benefits of changing lanes. And that puts you and everyone else on the highway at risk. Because when you change lanes, Redlmeyer says, you're roughly three times as likely to get into an accident compared to staying in your lane. Back to the end of our Seattle traffic experiment, I'm meeting Mariah at her parking garage near Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Where are you?
I just made it to the garage. How about you?
Oh, I am at 2nd and Columbia.
You're kidding! I was convinced I was so far behind.
Nope, I'm just coming to the stoplight now, so I'll be there in just a sec.
So after all the stress of moving between lanes, I got there under a minute faster. I put myself and other drivers at risk by changing lanes when I didn't have to, and there's the shame. For Here and Now, I'm David the Weaver Hyde in Seattle.
Let's go now to the tiny town of Abita Springs, Louisiana, which is on track to switch to 100% renewable energy by 2030, an idea spearheaded by Mayor Greg Lemons, who until recently was a climate change skeptic, also didn't pay a lot of attention to the benefits of renewable energy, and is a Republican. Donald Trump is now turning away from renewable energy and loosening regulations on fossil fuels, but Abita Springs is joining 69 other communities across the country, joining the Sierra Club's Ready for 100 campaign, all committing themselves to 100% renewable energy. Six of them, including Burlington, Vermont, and Greensburg, Kansas, are already powered by wind, solar, and other renewable. A handful have mayors who, like Greg Lemons, are Republicans. He joins us now. And Mayor Lemons, to your conversion, do I understand that you literally had a light bulb moment? You were counting light bulbs on the street lamps in your town.
You know, we're a small town. We have to count our pennies and watch our fiscal spending. So one of the things that we looked at, we had a funding source for our streetlights. Well, the streetlights were costing us more, about $15,000 a year more than we were bringing in from it. So we have to take general fund money to pay it. So I went out and looked at all 256 streetlights, analyzed them, and got rid of the really bad ones we didn't need, and then figured out a plan to replace the streetlights with energy-efficient solar lighting and night sky lighting for it, too. So we're looking to replace those with LED fixtures. Yes, I did count them all.
And it sounds like you concluded that, wait a second, I mean, there you are, in it's an oil-rich, oil-friendly state, Louisiana, but if I can replace the lights, how much more can I do? I mean, you've been described as a conservative Republican, and there are others like you. I'm reading about Rex Parris, who's mayor of Lancaster, California, who also had kind of a light bulb moment, the same kind of thinking, only his was, wait a minute, I'm in California, I can power things with the sun. And then had to kind of rethink everything he had thought because, as he said, up until then, I believe the Republican mantra that climate change is just a Chinese plot. We didn't need renewable resources. Now I recognize we do. Did you have that same kind of, wow, let me go and see what I can find out about all of this?
That's exactly what happened. You know, we had a little a fracking scare here in the town of Abita Springs. You know, fracking wells were going to pop up. So I did a lot of research on energies, renewable energies, sustainable energies, and things like that. As our utility department, we sell natural gas. But I'm a realist. We have to live in this world. You know, we have to be concerned about the environment. But I'm also the fiscal manager for a small town, so I have to watch my pennies. And there's a way to do that. I mean, you can't be the environment for all costs, and you can't be a business for all costs. So I did have a kind of a moment. My daughter put in solar panels on her house through a program we had in Louisiana. And I'm thinking, you know, she's paying pennies on her utility bill, where she used to pay $300 or $400. And I said, why can't we do that for the town of Ermita Springs? So I looked at the alternatives. I looked at the types of energies. And solar really makes sense for us.
In fact, I understand you even put solar panels on your boat.
I did. Actually, it made financial sense to me also.
We know that you also, when there was going to be fracking right across from the high school that's not too far from Ermita Springs, you did an investigation on your own and then challenged it in court, but they eventually dropped the project.
They did. They dropped it because of the price of oil at the time.
Yeah.
That well is a viable well, and they will now request a permit, I feel, in the near future for a fracking well. You know, Ermita Springs is named after an Indian princess that came here to drink the water to get healthy, and her name happened to be Ermita. So water is very, very important here to us. We have a coffee company. We have a beer company, which are all based around the water. So water is very important here. So anytime you go through the aquifer with as polluting effect that fracking wells will be, I'm concerned about it. There's also a lot of other things, you know, the amount of water it takes to do the wells. So, yeah, that's not very far from here at all.
I want to hear more about this evolution for you, because what did you think when you started researching not just the benefit of renewable energy, but the reason for it, the impact of climate change?
Our natural gas is a non-renewable energy source. There's going to be a day in the future where it won't be available. Well, as long as the sun is available, then we will have that energy source. And as a business person, I said, well, you know, we have to invest in the future. And if we in a small town can start to eat the elephant by doing a little bit of a town, we're going to be investing in the future. I looked at 15-watt solar panels for my boat, now up to 100-watt solar panels. There's 400-watt solar panels. So we invest in that. It's good for the environment. It's good for the business of producing that equipment. And it came to me through a series of programs and education that I did on renewable sources. And, you know, we're not going to have natural gas forever.
And you had not known that. I mean, it's really interesting because you've said, I've read you quoted saying, you know, people really don't talk that much about the environment. This is, again, an oil town. It's a town where the jobs are in the oil industry. Just about every position that's held in the area is held by a Republican. And it hasn't been popular. But I'm thinking, too, what did you see when you saw the polluting effects or when you saw the effects of ice melting and the oceans rising? And there you are on the coast. It must have been a bit of an eye-opener.
Well, it was. It was not just one moment. It was a series of moments. You know, again, I educated myself on the fracking process. Mm. I went to Denton, Texas. I went to Demick, Pennsylvania. I went to North Louisiana and looked at the process of doing fracking and the environmental issues that go along with that. And then I'm also a boater. You know, I go on the Gulf Coast. I look at a series of islands that we've had there that have been there for eons, and they're disappearing very quickly. So I don't know if it's climate change. I don't know if it's. I'm not a scientist, but I'd see the effects. As shepherds for this environment, we need to look at these things.
And it sounds like you're talking more about the cost savings, because maybe people, you know, will come along, but you're not making the pitch based on climate change, but on cost saving.
No, I'm doing both.
Oh, doing both.
Okay. It's absolutely both. And you know, we have to live in this world. We also have to pay the bills in this world. So I guess maybe that's my Republican hat on there. You know, we have to be financially stable. But you can do that through the solar panels that are on today. Yeah. Let me give you a prime example. We have a town hall that I'm in right now, which is my offices and fairly large building. Our electricity bill for this building in the summertime is about $600 a month. I'm going to lease solar panels. I'm going to put 188 solar panels on that, which is going to provide most of electricity during peak times. And the cost to lease those solar panels is $400 a month. And that will provide majority of the electricity that I need. So I'm going to probably save a couple hundred bucks a month. Hmm. Plus, I will absolutely put out there that the town of Ermita Springs is not just talking about energy sustainability. They're doing something about it. We've just recently installed some electric vehicle charging stations donated by Tesla. So we're trying to do everything we do in our community to be renewable energies.
What are you hearing from residents, though? Are they worried about their oil industry jobs?
Yes, the ones that are in the industry absolutely are. There's a lot of publicity going on. You know, there's a national publicity about oil and gas. And the ones that are in the industry are concerned. But let me tell you what's happening in Louisiana. We're building liquid natural gas terminals to export our resources to the China market and to the European market, which basically means that they're going to be the prices are going to balance. We're going to be paying more for natural gas because of that. So there is a industry thing that is going to be hurting the residents of the United of here. Maybe more gases, but because everything's becoming automated, the jobs are not as plentiful as they are preaching.
Right. Look, it's an interesting time. You voted for Donald Trump in 2016. He's moved away from renewable energy, withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement. What would you want to say to him?
I'd ask him to reconsider both of those aspects. Kind of like I do. Look at both of them and reconsider both of them, because there is something going on that we need to be sure that we're not the biggest contributor of. I'd ask him to reconsider it.
That's Abita Springs, Louisiana Mayor Greg Lemons. He's pledged to have his town 100% using renewable energy by 2030. Mayor Lemons, best of luck to you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate talking to you.
And by the way, if Abita Springs sounds familiar, it is home to the Pushmo. That's become a huge annual parade of push mowers. So they've long been on the front lines of renewable energy. They just didn't know it.
Google is having a hard time retaining its Black and Latino workers. That's according to the company's annual diversity report released late last week. It showed Google's Black and Latino workers made up just 6% of the total workforce. Not much of a surprise there. For years, Silicon Valley has remained largely white and male, despite apparent efforts to change. Let's take a look at the numbers with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Rani Mola is data editor for Recode. She joins us from New York. Hi there, Rani.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. So the big takeaway from this report was that Google is losing Black and Latino workers more than any other ethnic group. What's going on? Where and why are they going?
Well, I think they're realizing that it's not enough to simply hire people of color. You have to work on retaining them, making Google a place that they want to work. If you remember last fall, James Damore put out this memo. He's a Google engineer who put out this piece saying women are biologically unsuited to certain jobs and that diversity hiring was lowering the bar for Google employees. That sort of thing creates a hostile work environment. And you have to think, do you want to work there if your colleagues think this about you?
So Google started publishing these annual stats in terms of diversity 4 years ago. So if you're looking at the current breakdown between gender and ethnicity, what is it now?
For overall, women are barely up. They went up 0.1% or 10 basis points to 30.9% of Google employees, whereas Black and Latinx went up to 2.5% and 3.6% respectively. You have to remember that women are 50% of the population, Blacks are 13%, and Latinx are 18%. So this is woefully underrepresented.
In its diversity report, Google says it wants to move from unconscious bias to conscious action. What's the action?
Well, they actually have to, you know, put their money where their mouth is. And I think they're doing that. Recently, Google employees got together with investors for a proposal that would link executive pay to diversity and inclusion metrics. So just much like a lot of executives, their pay is linked to the stock price. This would be link their pay to, you know, are we hitting our diversity goals? And, you know, Google's stated goal is to represent their users so that they can make better products for their users. I think this is just good business.
So Google's not the only company with diversity challenges. How does it compare to Facebook, Twitter, to other big tech companies?
They're all making incremental gains, but they're all still doing poorly, depending on the metric. I think when you're looking at these diversity reports, it's important to look at not just the overall numbers, but the tech and leadership positions. These are the high-paying, high-profile jobs you think of when you think about tech. And then when you look at, you know, Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon, they're all within percentage points of each other. But, you know, they're also the most valuable companies in the United States. They're worth hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that they do better than this.
Mm. You mentioned Amazon there, and it's just had its own diversity controversy. Just last month, employees called out the company for the makeup of its board. Remind us what the Amazon board looks like.
Well, Amazon's board has three women and no people of color. The controversy was that Amazon shareholders put forth a proposal called for the Rooney Rule, which would require when a board seat opens that they consider in the pool of candidates women and people of color. Just look at them as possible options. It's a pretty simple ask, I think, but it took the company a little while to formalize that rule.
So we're looking at a big company like Google, for instance, and some of the giants as leading the way in terms of diversifying their workforce. But Silicon Valley is small of lots of small, tiny companies. Is it possible that change could come from the ground up, from the little companies making changes?
I think so. But of course, from top down, the rising tide raises all ships. I think that no matter which position you are in, but especially these high-profile ones, representation matters. It matters to see women and people of color in these jobs to show that it's possible. And, you know, the more that are hired in those positions, the bigger pool of experience women and people of color. And I think that's good for all tech companies. So large or small, regardless of size, I think it's a matter of understanding that diversity is important and hiring accordingly.
Rani, Silicon Valley has had a reputation for so long for being so male and so white, and there's these very public efforts to change that. But as somebody who works in data, in tech, who's also a person of colour, how long do you think it will be before you look at Silicon Valley and you think, oh, okay, that's America?
At this rate, it's going to take a while. But I mean, if you look at the long view, it is moving. They're making efforts. And these are tech companies. Their whole business is innovating. I hope that they, more than other industries, would be able to do this sooner.
Rani Mola, data editor for Recode, thank you.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Femi Okeh.
So you are. I just want to say
nothing gets
welcome.
By you, you fantastic journalist, Robin Young.
Many know you from your work hosting The Stream on Al Jazeera English and our Friday conversations about the news on social media. And this week you're going to be giving Jeremy and I and the rest of our host team
My
a breather.
Great pleasure.
So thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I just have a quick question.
Go ahead.
Trying to place the accent.
Uh-huh.
And?
Born in London, seasoned in Atlanta, where I was known as the Black Mary Poppins.
There she is, Femi Okeh. I'm Robin Young. Welcome. It's Here and Now.